This is episode number 9 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, April 19th, 2007. I'm Jerry Breda of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Up for discussion this week, the FCC begins an inquiry into net neutrality, an update on the NSA's wiretapping of Americans, and Vonage is reeling from Verizon's patent smackdown. Joining me to discuss these topics are Tech Liberation Front contributors, starting with James Gattuso of the Heritage Foundation. Hi, James.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. We got Tim Lee of the Cato Institute.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tim. And Adam Thierer of the Progress and Freedom Foundation.
Hi, Jerry.
Hey, Adam. Our guest this week is Derek Slater of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Glad to have you with us, Derek.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Well, first up, the Federal Communications Commission begins an inquiry into net neutrality. This comes on the heel of the Federal Trade Commission workshop on the topic, and the FTC is expected to come out with a report sometime later this year. James, what did the FCC do, and why is it important? Why is it different?
Well, the FCC is what they did is they asked questions about whether they should change their policy statement that they issued last year on broadband. And you may remember that policy statement had four factors as to behavior on the net, non-discrimination principles. What this is an inquiry where the FCC is simply asking questions about whether that should be changed, expanded, or otherwise modified. And it's questions that go across the board, everything from competition in the area, in broadband markets, to providers offer parental controls that block packets containing sexually explicit material. So I think by itself, and Adam, I think it's going to disagree, but by itself this is innocuous. It really, what happens with this will depend upon who's in charge of the FCC at the time this all finishes.
Now, when the FCC put out its five principles, its policy statement, it did it the same day that it said that broadband or that telco provided broadband was not to be regulated under as a common carrier. Is that right?
That's right. It was part of that deal, really. It was a quid pro quo for votes on that policy decision. Now, there's no action-forcing event such as that would force any of the three Republican commissioners who are, to some degree or another, against changes. There's nothing immediate that's going to force them to change their votes.
Adam,
I think to a large extent, this is something where Kevin Martin, the chairman, wants to establish a record that there is no need for net neutrality regulations. The danger, of course, is that once that record's set and a new chairman comes in, a new majority of the FCC, anything could happen.
Adam, I wanted to ask you if you could explain to listeners how things are regulated at the FCC and how different classifications would mean regulation for certain services.
Well, obviously, there's some concern here about will broadband come to be regulated like traditional telecommunication services, but there's been a lot of wrangling about that over the years and in recent years. But the core of the problem I feel with what's going on right now at the FCC is that the situation remains very deeply politicized. Part of what the FCC is doing is based, I think, sort of on a turf battle with the FTC, because the Federal Trade Commission is now getting involved and interested in this issue. It's almost like the kind of battles you see in the Congress when the Commerce Committee will announce a hearing and the Judiciary Committee will announce a hearing a week later, sort of dueling hearings to exercise authority or turf consciousness. And the problem is that all this activity has me worried personally as a regulatory skeptic, because I certainly have no problem with the FCC necessarily asking questions, but usually when the agency asks questions, they also seek to provide answers in the form of regulation. And I, of course, am very concerned about what net neutrality means. No one's really got an idea of what it's going to mean in practice. But from the questions that are being posed in this notice of inquiry, the thing that has me worried is that some of these things that are being teed up about pricing practices of these carriers, how broadband services are priced, things that are quite bizarre in my opinion, like James mentioned about our packets of child porn and pornography block, things like that, are being asked in here. So we're getting into content issues. And basically every type of internet broadband carrier, internet content company you can imagine is covered by this inquiry when it asks about whose practices are potentially discriminatory. So, again, this is why I referred to it as a potential Pandora's box that's being opened here, because we don't really have any idea where this is going to end up.
Guys, how much authority does the FCC have to regulate this sort of thing? I mean, if the FCC's, you know, all five commissioners decided they really wanted to protect net neutrality and issue regulations, could they do that, or would they have to go back to Congress to get that authority?
Well, you know, if you read the Communications Act, there is nothing explicitly in the Act at all that gives them authority over broadband now that it's been ruled not to be a telecommunications service. However, over the course of a number of years, the Commission has, through legal decisions and its own actions, asserted what's called ancillary jurisdiction over areas that are related to in the same field as areas that they can regulate. And this allows them to regulate beyond their explicit authority in the Communications Act. To me, it's always been very, very flimsy and really a dangerous doctrine to say a regulatory agency can regulate things that it has not been granted authority to regulate. But that's what the courts have ruled. Now, this anything the FCC does would be challenged, and there very likely could be a court decision limiting their authority. But right now, they're acting on the assumption that they do have that authority in an implicit sense in the Act.
One thing that I find very interesting that they ask, one question that they ask in the notice of inquiry, is whether they have the authority to enforce the policy statement that has their five principles. And it's very interesting to me, because even though they may have ancillary jurisdiction, I think it might be the case that they need to put out rules for comment and then adopt rules before they can enforce any net neutrality regulation. A lot of people talk about how the Madison River case and how that shows how the FCC already has authority to prosecute somebody who's discriminating. And in fact, Madison River was prosecuted before the principles were put out, and it relied on Title II jurisdiction. And there was never an outcome of that case. Yes.
That was a case where a DSL provider tried to block the OIP service, is that correct?
That's right. Thanks for clarifying that, Tim. Basically, you had a DSL provider, it was a phone company, who had a competing, I think they had a competing VoIP application, and they also had competing just regular voice service. And they were blocking the ports that were used by VoIP applications. And that never got resolved in any adjudication. The FCC basically threatened them, and they signed a consent decree where they agreed to stop doing it, but it was never really adjudicated. So the question is, can the FCC enforce these policy principles, or, as Adam fears, is this going to lead them to believe that, well, we've got these policy principles, we like them, and now we're going to have to give them teeth?
And you're right to point out that the Madison River case was decided before the broadband markets were in fact deregulated or declared not to be telecom. I think this whole thing could bring up a very interesting case before the courts as to the extent of ancillary jurisdiction. You know, this is a doctrine that was established 35 years ago in the context of whether the FCC could regulate cable networks via its authority over broadcast networks. So it came up in a completely different context and has grown beyond anything that I think was imagined at that time. So it could be interesting if the FCC does try to assert ancillary jurisdiction. Perhaps it will be struck down in the courts and will end up better than we are now. But I'm an optimist. Adam's the pessimist today.
Derek, what do you think about this?
I was going to ask, I mean, Adam, what sort of questions would you be okay with the FCC asking or inquiring about, right? This notice of inquiry started a fairly long, lengthy process of looking into these issues. And you're right, it casts a wide net, but should they not be looking at this area at all? There seem to be some pretty complex issues here.
Well, there's certainly complex issues here. There's complex issues surrounding a lot of what takes place online. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm comfortable with a federal regulatory agency looking into it. I mean, the very fact that an agency asks questions in and of itself, I guess there's nothing wrong with that, but the problem is that we know there's usually something that follows that. It's rare for issues to be teed up and then nothing to be resolved or no follow-through. And I'm not saying the questions they ask are not good ones. There are some legitimate questions in there, ones that we've been asking on the Tech Liberation Front blog for a long time. I just fear, because I'm a regulatory skeptic and fearful of where this might be taking us, that the very fact that they've opened up a process that could easily become politicized and very regulatory, we've already seen the seeds planted for the birth of a new regulatory regime here.
How much of a difference would it make if a change of administrations, if a Democrat gets elected in 2008?
Well, we can answer that question quite easily by looking at Michael Copps's statement tacked onto the back of this thing, where he talks about the death of the Internet and about sort of this endless gloom and doomism and the sky is falling kind of scenario. I think Commissioner Copps is ready, willing, and able to basically become a very aggressive Internet regulator if we give him the chance.
I think that's right, and I'm not as worried as Adam about the inquiry. In fact, the FCC starts inquiries all the time, and nothing ever happens. If there's one thing good about the FCC, perhaps it's that it takes so long to do anything. but what does scare me is the statements by the two of the commissioners, Michael Copps and even Jonathan Edelstein. But Copps in particular is almost a religious fervor for regulation that you see in this dissent. You really should look at it. And what struck me in particular was the last line, saying that I will not dissent from the one small step forward we take today, but I do lament our not making a Neil Armstrong giant leap for mankind, presumably a giant leap towards regulation. And I thought it was interesting that in the context of this 21st century technology that they're considering regulating, that he goes back to a 1960s really dead end technology that was government funded and led nowhere. You'd think that he'd be looking at 21st century analogies, but I think this shows that some commissioners are still living in the 1960s.
All right. Well, let's move on. Next up, we're going to talk about the NSA and the warrantless wiretapping of Americans. Derek, EFF recently launched a new campaign at stopillegalspying.org. Could you refresh our memories a bit about the NSA controversy and then tell us what's new?
Sure. Well, as was revealed it was revealed in December of 2005, so quite a while ago now, the NSA has been spying on millions of ordinary Americans' communications, both over telephone and internet, kind of conducting the sort of dragnet surveillance. And EFF is suing AT&T for its role. ACLU has sued the government for conducting what the president has called the terrorist surveillance program. Those cases are now moving through the court system. Now, at the same time, the Bush administration has been pushing for legislation that would sweep this program of illegal, massive, unprecedented surveillance, sweep it under the rug, and also broadly expand surveillance powers, both now and in the future. So both EFF, ACLU, a bunch of organizations were fighting those sorts of bills last year, and the bills were held off. And what we've been pushing for now is for Congress to step up and investigate this still shadowy surveillance program that the Bush administration has been so hesitant to reveal any details about and has been fighting back in the courts to keep secret. So we've been pushing for investigations, and meanwhile, once again, the Bush administration is pushing new legislation that would expand surveillance powers and do a whole bunch of other quite nasty things, including letting off the hook companies like AT&T, potentially letting them off the hook for their role in the program, basically granting companies that assisted the surveillance program with blanket immunity. That's a very dangerous proposition. These companies who helped the program should be held accountable for their role in helping the government conduct illegal surveillance of ordinary Americans. So stopillegalspying.org is a new site set up by EFF, ACLU, People for the American Way, a whole coalition of organizations, Liberty, downsizedc.org, Liberty Coalition, and where people can go send a letter to their congressman asking for investigations and no legislation expanding surveillance powers. They can also get a button they can put on their website, put on their blog to help spread the word and hopefully generate some grassroots energy towards Congress to get some real oversight of the administration and help rein in this illegal surveillance.
Derek, so much, I understand, of this program is under wraps and it's really unknown. What do we know for a fact about the program?
Well, as we've alleged in our lawsuit, that the program is basically doing dragnet surveillance, looking at the telephone internet communications of millions of ordinary Americans. It's far broader than the what the president has called the narrow program of the terrorist surveillance program. But still, you're right that much has been kind of kept under wraps by the administration. That's why we need such vigorous oversight and investigation by Congress, right? This Congress's job is to be a check on the president's power and hold it accountable and make sure the law is not being broken along with courts, right? And that simply, there's not enough of that being done right now. Congress needs to step up and do its job in that way.
Derek, have you gotten any feedback from the new leadership in Congress? Are they, is this something that's on their to-do list?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly Senator Leahy has signaled that this would be one of the issues that would be investigated. Unfortunately, that still hasn't happened yet. And in fact, just this week, it got delayed, but the Senate Intelligence Committee was going to hold a hearing on the Bush administration's new proposed surveillance bill that would expand their powers and grant this blanket immunity. Right? What's needed is not kind of evaluations of those sort of proposals, but a real investigation of the program first, right? It would be totally irresponsible of Congress to legislate in the dark about this shadowy program and expand powers without more being known first.
Yeah, absolutely. So if what kind of remedy are you looking for in the lawsuit against AT&T? Assuming you win the case, what would you get or what would AT&T have to do?
Well, I mean, we're a little bit from there, but certainly the first thing is getting the program to stop, right? The first and most important thing is protecting the privacy of the millions of ordinary Americans whose rights have been violated here and enjoining that activity. The second thing is also be holding AT&T responsible under the law as they can be. We hold these companies responsible for protecting their customers' privacy and not turning over this data to the government without abiding by the law, because they provide a real important check on government surveillance powers, right? They're an important barrier to letting to the government just kind of invading privacy however it likes. So that's why companies like AT&T really need to be held accountable.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Derek. Moving on, we've got finally Vonage is reeling from Verizon's patent smackdown. Tim, tell us the details of this.
Sure. Well, this is a case that's been underway for a little over a year, I think. And last month, they handed down a decision. A jury awarded $58 million to Verizon based on Vonage's infringement of three patents. Two of them cover the translation of IP addresses to phone numbers, and the third one is a patent on accessing a telephone network wirelessly via the internet. And this case, I find this case very troubling because these are extraordinarily broad patents. It's not quite clear yet. I believe the decision hasn't been unsealed yet, so it's not clear exactly how the judge and the jury were interpreting these patents. But it seems, at least in principle, that it could cover any technology that translates from phone numbers to IP addresses, which means any system that connects the PSTN, the phone network, to the internet would fall into these patents, which would effectively give Verizon a monopoly over the VoIP market.
So basically, Vonage would have to shut down or at least change their business model dramatically. Is that
what? Yes, that's what Verizon is seeking. In fact, the judge couple weeks ago, I think, handed down an injunction against Vonage, saying that Vonage is not allowed to sign up any new customers.
Wow.
And presumably, if they lose at the federal appeals court, that would be extended to being required to shut down their network altogether. So this really is Verizon trying to use the patent system to shut down a competitor and effectively give them a legal monopoly over the VoIP market. Now, there's an open question. Their other major competitors are the local cable monopolies within their region. And Vonage's big strategic mistake is that Vonage did not seek any patents. And so when Verizon sued them, usually the way this works is, Company A sues Company B, and then Company B looks through its patent portfolio to find something that Company A, for instance, sues back. Vonage didn't do that, and so they were, completely naked, and all they could do is argue that Verizon's patents were invalid or didn't apply to them, and the jury didn't buy that. So the cable companies, presumably, they're larger companies, presumably they've been a little bit more savvy, and hopefully they have patent portfolios of their own that can act as a deterrent to Verizon taking this very aggressive posture. But Vonage is really hurting. Their CEO stepped down last week, which they said was not related to the lawsuit, but I can't imagine that it didn't have an effect. And next week they're arguing for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit temporarily stayed the injunction against signing up new customers. Next week they're going to be arguing to make that injunction permanent while they go through other appeals. If they lose that, if they're not able to sign up new customers, I think it's very likely they're going to go bankrupt because they're currently not making any money. Their business plan depends on dramatically expanding their customer base, and they have a fairly high turnover rate. So if they aren't allowed to sign up new customers, their customer base will start to drop off, and there's no way they're ever going to turn a profit.
Tim, how likely is it that the patent actually would be read to cover all translation of IP addresses to telephone numbers? Because from what I've seen, it looks like a lot of people are talking about workarounds. Even Vonage says that they're studying methods for designing around the patents, although they say it'll take a few months to get that done. So it looks like Vonage itself is seeing this as not a patent that covers any translation of IP addresses, but just this particular method.
Well, part of the problem with our patent system, I think, is that it's very, very unclear for a lot of patents, especially with regard to technology, which is very complex, what the scope of a patent is. I've seen conflicting reports. There are some Vonage did make some statements that they're working on a workaround, but apparently they also made a filing with the SEC saying they thought it was unlikely they'd be able to find a workaround, so it's not clear. But, I mean, Research in Motion said the same thing, that they're working on a workaround. But if you read the actual patent, what it describes is a DNS server, which is DNS is the server that translates IP addresses to domain names. It describes one that also can translate into phone numbers and do some other things. And it's any VoIP application is going to have some software that performs that function of taking. You've got one end of the call is on the telephone network, one end of the call is on the internet, and you're going to have some server somewhere that translates between those. And so it's plausible. I mean, the other problem with this is even if at some point the courts rule that rules that this patent has some narrower scope, in the meantime, you have this chilling effect on innovation where you'd be stupid to start a VoIP company right now because it's not clear whether the patent covers all VoIP or certain only some VoIP, and if it only covers some, it's not clear what you have to do to invent around it. It's very, very murky, and I think that's problematic.
So, Tim, what's the reform solution to these problems?
Well, my hobby horse, I mean, there's two things. One is my hobby horse. I don't think software should be patentable in the first place, and so that would at least take care of the IP to phone number DNS patent. The other one is about wireless internet, which I think in that case, I'm really hoping that the Supreme Court tightens up the obviousness standards in the Teleflex case. There's actually two Supreme Court cases before the court right now. One is the Teleflex case, which deals with the obviousness standard, and the one side in that case is arguing that the courts have been too permissive in allowing very obvious patents to get through the approval process. And then the other is the Microsoft v. AT&T case, which looks at software patents overseas. It's not specifically focused on the software patent aspect of it, but it certainly the Supreme Court could say something about the software patent issue. So these are both cases where I think the Supreme Court might at least partially solve these problems in the next few months, make it more difficult to abuse the patent system. But there's a lot of other reform proposals that I haven't had time to look at in any detail. I think probably there needs to be reforms at the patent office, but I couldn't say right now what the best way to do that is.
It strikes me as obviously a difficult problem. Tim mentioned not having software patentable. It seems to me to be a different debate, because if the problems are that this particular patent is being read too broadly and that uncertainty is created, none of that goes to software, the validity of software being patented in itself. It seems like it's two separate problems that are admittedly very difficult to solve, but not necessarily limited to software and not necessarily applicable to all software patents.
Well, part of the problem, I think, is the complexity of software. It means that, in practice, software patents tend to be very, very broad and very vague. Because if you wanted to be very specific about what a piece of software did, you would put the source code in the patent. But obviously, we already have copyright protection for the source code, so you have to describe it in some broader sense. And in practice, what that means is you end up with patents that cover things like wireless email and one-click shopping. I mean, there are other software patents that are narrower than that, but at least in my, from what I've read, there are a lot of software patents that are way too broad. Now, it might be that if the court rules in Teleflex that, raises the bar so that only really non-obvious patents qualify, it might be that the number of software patents would go down a lot and remaining software patents wouldn't be so problematic.
Which is what they should be doing anyway, yeah.
Right, so you're right. I mean, it might be that this... there are other arguments that we probably don't want to get into why I think software shouldn't be patentable, but it's certainly possible that a good ruling in Teleflex would solve most of this problem without having to change the issue of software patents. But it's also worth keeping in mind that the software patents have only really been built for 10 or 15 years, and so I don't think it's in some ways I think changing the obviousness standard is a more radical change than outlawing software patents, because it's much more deeply embedded that, the obviousness standards have been evolving for 50 or 100 years, and the software patents pretty much, the courts, the patent office wouldn't allow you to apply for a software patent until, I think, the early 90s.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tim. Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. Thanks to James Gattuso, Tim Lee, Adam Thier, and Derek Slater. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for the show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. Goodbye.